for our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners. Your North Carolina Reading Service now brings you... Indie Week, The Independent, read by John Federson for this week's issue, dated November 27th of 2025. Of course, you'll hear this on the 28th of November, Friday, which is when it airs for the first time, but I'm here rattling around the studio by myself on Thanksgiving morning. And I hope you're headed to a lovely get-together or time by yourself or whatever involving something delicious. And so, let's get to our issue today. And I'll start out with one of the few articles in here that is food-related. Not the happiest of articles, but a hopeful one. The country is facing a hunger crisis. In Durham, as need grows, so does the Emmanuel Food Pantry. Corn chowder, cucumber salad, mashed potatoes. As we sort through a large cardboard box of fresh produce, the woman beside me details all the ways she plans to transform these groceries into meals. I make a chicken soup, too, she says, adding to the list, and my grandson says it's so good. This woman, who shares her recipes but not her name, writes Andrea Richards, has 8 grandchildren and not enough food, which is why she takes the bus every Wednesday to Durham's Emmanuel Food Pantry, EFP, a nonprofit that runs a weekly mobile food distribution service from the parking lot of Iglesia Presbyteriana Emmanuel on Roxborough Street. She says, if this wasn't here, I'd have to go home and find something to sell, go to the pawn shop to get food. When I ask if the 16-ounce container of milk she received is enough for both the chowder and the potatoes, she says, I make it work. This sentiment, like the women's careful process of food inventory and transport, is a microcosm of the activities all around us in the busy parking lot. Today, in the span of just 2 hours, more than 650 cars will cycle through, moving through a team of volunteers who direct traffic, scan tickets, pop trunks and load in produce boxes and large bags of shelf-stable pantry items. If there are kids in the car, volunteers offer one of a limited number of desserts. When supplies run low, volunteers driving pallet lifters bring more boxes and bags. The efficiency of motion feels factory-esque, but the atmosphere is warm and fun. Music plays, and greetings are exchanged in English and Spanish. Along with the drive-in service, another 100 or so clients pick up their food from the pantry's walk-up line, which, like the car service, requires nothing more than signing up online for a spot. There are also delivery options for homebound clients and a special pickup time for church members. Joy Newburn, EFP's part-time operations manager, is handing out flyers with instructions for how to sign up for the next week's service, that is, when she's not directing traffic, managing volunteers in fluorescent vests, or doing 100 million other things. Newburn is one of only 2 EFP employees, both of whom started just this year, even though the pantry is going on its 6th year of service. In 5 years, the initiative has grown from a handful of folks serving 30 families a weekly hot meal in the church basement to this, Durham County's largest emergency food assistance program, with more than 150 volunteers a week that serve 860 families. Newburn says that when she came on board, the pantry's distribution setup was already a well-oiled machine, but she still felt like she was drinking from a fire hose. Today, her buoyancy is evident and contagious. Or maybe the cheerful optimism and make-it-work determinism I see all around is just the ethos necessary to make an all-volunteer effort work so well and for so long. Back at the walk-up table, Bruce, a disabled veteran who rides over in his scooter from a nearby group home, is cracking jokes with two longtime volunteers and picking up his goods. "I get him talking," he says of the volunteers. He tells me he makes too much to qualify for the government's Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, but not enough to cover his grocery bill. He says a lot of veterans don't get enough, which is why he drives his Rolls-Royce here every week. Of course, even if Bruce did qualify for SNAP, it wouldn't necessarily make a difference. October's government shutdown put an abrupt stop to SNAP benefit distribution, which put the 1.5 million low-income North Carolina residents who rely on that program to feed their families at an even greater risk. Those delayed benefits are now slowly beginning to return, but for many recipients, SNAP wasn't enough in the first place to keep healthy food on the table through the end of the month. Plus, SNAP faces permanent cuts as Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill Act becomes law. Enacting its provisions will push millions of Americans off the nation's largest anti-hunger program. If folks were still hungry with SNAP benefits, the pain of the shutdown's temporary suspension are only a preview of a much worse disaster to come. Though the steady stream of cars stretches around the block and backs up into the neighborhood where volunteers are positioned to help traffic flow as smoothly as possible, few neighbors complain about the congestion. Maybe because seeing all the vehicles lined up makes it apparent how widespread food insecurity is and gives close proximity to a problem that, for how big it is, remains mostly unseen. Food insecurity is largely invisible. You can't always see hunger, but you certainly can see its effects in chronic diseases, poor health, children who are struggling in school due to developmental differences. Historically, North Carolina has had one of the highest rates of food insecurity in the United States. And according to 2023 data from Feeding America, in Durham County, 13.8% of residents cannot access enough food. Miguel Rubiera, who along with his wife Margaret founded Emmanuel Food Pantry in 2020, said, "Once you know that almost 50,000 people are food insecure in this community that has so much brain power and so much wealth, you cannot turn a blind eye. It's almost inconceivable that this was such a hidden issue for so long." After careers running other nonprofits, including Durham's Habitat for Humanity, the Rubiera's retirement has been spent building both the food pantry and a related tutoring program, which is also held on church grounds. Knowing the Rubiera's skills as passionate advocates and leaders, Pastor Julio Ramirez-Eve initially asked for their help in turning the church's Wednesday night dinners into a mobile food pantry during the pandemic. Seeing the growing need during lockdown, the couple worked to source food, raise funds, and recruit help, growing the organization organically and welcoming volunteers and their input every step of the way. Margaret Rubiera, in a Zoom interview, says, "We did not sit down in the spring of 2020 and say, 'Okay, we're going to get this food pantry going and this is our strategic plan.' It was all just responding to the needs of the moment and continuing constantly just to respond. It's only been recently that we've been able to sit down and really strategize for the future. That future includes an advisory board, which transitioned into a board of trustees in 2023, the year the pantry became its own nonprofit organization, separate from the church that houses it. As the pantry has grown, its real estate needs have expanded as well. Growth that the church has been able to accommodate so far, though it does seem that the operation is pulling at the modest building's seams." Its biggest expansion is the appointment of a new executive director, Pam Ryan, who has been on the job for only a few weeks. With an extensive background in the anti-hunger field, she's excited to be leading such a vital organization and says the volunteers are rivaled by none. They clamor for those volunteer spots. Ryan's arrival will allow the Rubieros to step back from day-to-day operations, but they are hardly abandoning the cause. Indeed, the couple plans to move into a larger advocacy role, working with 15 other area food pantries as a coalition, with the hopes of changing perceptions about anti-hunger work. Miguel says, everyone who has been born is entitled to food and shelter. That's social justice, not charity. He's especially excited to develop private-public partnerships to help alleviate food insecurity and says, we have so many businesses in our community talking about food as health, food as ceremony, but they don't do baloney. They talk a lot. They have conferences. They write articles, but they don't do anything about it. With a coalition of pantries, we're going to go to the people and say, okay, put the money where your mouth is. During this moment of transition and growth for EFP, all signs nationally and locally show that the need for food assistance is only going to increase, and the government shutdown SNAP debacle is just one of the many reasons pantries like EFP are under pressure. People didn't have enough to eat before the federal cuts to food banks and SNAP benefits, so donations from private entities and individuals are essential to cover the gaps. Jacob Boehm, who serves as chair of EFP's advisory board, said, the reality is none of us had any fraction of an idea that it would be this big or around for this long. It's just kind of been kind of holding on for dear life to do whatever we can to meet this growing demand. Boehm, a local chef whose company Snap P creates pop-up dinners around the Triangle, first started volunteering at that pantry 5 years ago. He said, I kept hearing rumblings of this food pantry on Roxborough that was no questions asked and had really good food. It stood out as a magical unicorn of food assistant programs. No barriers, no questions asked, so anyone can come. And then a prioritization of high-quality fresh produce, he continues. Situations where organizations have to make do without such produce, he says, makes jobs 10 times harder because you have to worry about cold chain storage and spoilage. When I compliment the produce boxes in front of us, saying they look like the sort of thing you get from a CSA box, he says, you'd be lucky to get a box like that at your CSA. His pride in what EFP gives away is well deserved. The controlled chaos of Wednesday's distribution is only possible because of another well-practiced process, one with even more moving parts, food donations. Along with donations from the Food Bank of Central and Eastern North Carolina, the Interfaith Food Shuttle, Farmer Food Share, and food recovery programs from stores like Costco, Wegmans, and Whole Foods, EFP accepts all kinds of smaller donations as well. Tuesdays are when the big trucks come in and the major donations are unloaded. Once again, trained volunteers use pallet jacks and organize stacks of produce, pantry items, and bread in Tetris-like configurations. It's like Christmas morning and moving day merged. Stuff all around, boxes full of surprises, but once again, there's far more method than madness. Volunteers know their roles and jobs and do them to rocking music, organizing items, building and breaking down boxes, filling up bags with rice, beans, pasta, and dry goods. Produce box assembly is where the real action is. First, the produce gets sorted. The recovered items that aren't fresh enough to be included are composted or cooked for a volunteer meal. There is no food waste. Farmers come pick up the compost. Then those numbers are tallied. How many ears of corn in each box? One or two cabbages? Volunteers pick a vegetable and then hit repeat, filling box after box. All this happens under the watchful eye of Newbern, who keeps inventory of the donations via a program on her phone and can gauge from experience where the gaps are. If she sees something important missing, say tomatoes, she can supplement thanks to cash donations and place an order with the local merchant. She has a standing order with El Camino, a Mexican food distributor just minutes away, to buy bananas. All the foods she uses to supplement donations need to be healthy, fresh, and attuned to a culturally diverse audience. There's a real waste-not-want-not mentality to all operations, which makes sense, given that this is a group of people who know the value of a good meal and the level of scarcity around. Plus, intentionality abounds in little decisions that support the organization's core mission. Instead of ordering pizza to feed the volunteers, who are often working through their lunch hours, the board decided to hire a member of the church to prepare meals on site, made from recovered food that couldn't go into the boxes. The practice isn't just a smart way to use food that's too fragile or wilted for distribution. It's a way to break bread together that embodies the spirit of community. The people working here share the same food as the clients who use the service. Margaret Rubiera says, and I agree, one thing I have absolutely loved has been seeing how, in these two-hour volunteer shifts, people have come together, gotten to know one another, free from the artificial barriers that we normally set up. I felt that the erosion of boundaries about how exchanging food and recipes creates connections, no matter where you fall economically. By the end of this day, the wall of refrigerators I watched fill up just one day before are now bare, as are the shelves and tables where the produce boxes and pantry bags were made and stored. Ditto in the parking lot. The pallets full of food are almost gone, but the line of cars continues. There used to be leftover boxes and bags that would be shared with other nearby food pantries. These days, there are no leftovers. It's a week later, and the circumstances are different. The arrival of Federal Customs and Border Protection agents in Durham, spotted yesterday less than a mile from the church, has raised concerns about today's distribution. Many area businesses that cater to a Latinx clientele are closed. The leadership of EFP, meanwhile, has been hard at work trying to figure out how to keep its neighborhood safe. The beautiful boxes of produce are ready, the staples are bagged, plus members of the Triangle Association of Muslim American Mothers plan to distribute halal chickens at today's pickup, as they do every year for Thanksgiving. The threat of ICE activity in the area is a new constraint, yet EFP does what it has years of experience doing, responding to the needs of the moment. Calls are made and processes are changed on the fly. Siembra NC, an immigration advocacy group, is on hand to help, as are more volunteers. Pastor Ramirez Eve, who for 20 years has led the church that houses the EFP, offers a long view of what is happening today, telling me how the food pantry at its very beginnings, before it became its own entity, began in difficult times, that is, the economic uncertainty at the end of the Bush administration. He says of today's upheaval, right now we have another crisis affecting our community and we try to deal with that. The idea is to be present for the community to provide space and support, especially for people who have a lot of need. That's the way, that's the mission we have. Around us, service has started. Cars are pulling in, and along with a produce box and a pantry bag, volunteers are loading those halal chickens and eggs into trunks or at the walk-up stand, placing them carefully into shopping carts. Ramirez Ivy continues, the good thing is the community is coming. People in the neighborhoods are coming and asking how they can be helpful. That's beautiful at this particular moment. I think it's a blessing to see how many people are coming here to be a good helper. We are in unity with the Durham community. Next article, North Carolina leaders highlight business impacts of federal immigration raids. Last Tuesday, Leslie Zuniga, a nail tech from Durham, closed the doors of her Liberty Street business, as did many other business owners all across the Triangle, Zuniga said at a press conference with other local business owners in Raleigh last Thursday at the nonprofit Education Justice Alliance's headquarters in southeast Raleigh. ICE was raiding our neighborhood. Clients did not feel safe driving down the street or even driving near Liberty Street. Zuniga, a first-generation business owner and a child of Mexican immigrants, became emotional, reflecting on the events of the days prior. She asked, "How can we organize? What can we do next? Everyone deserves to live and work without fear. Small businesses deserve stability. Families deserve peace. We deserve to grow together. We deserve to be able to feel safe in our businesses, our homes, walking down the street, driving to work." Last week, as Customs and Border Protection agents raided large cities, including Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte, construction sites across the Triangle sat mostly empty, including Raleigh's upcoming $260 million new City Hall. Restaurants closed their doors, and international groceries pivoted to delivery. Child care centers asked parents if they could keep their children at home because not enough of their staff felt safe coming into work to care for them. Immigrant workers comprise large portions of various industries in North Carolina, including construction, 29%, accommodation and food service, 18%, manufacturing, 17%, according to data from the state's Department of Commerce. Between 2017 and 2022, Hispanic-owned businesses grew by 65% to close to 100,000 in the state. North Carolina is home to nearly 1 million immigrants, including 560,000 non-citizens and an estimated 325,000 who are undocumented, according to Immigration Research Initiative. That's a nonpartisan think tank. Between 21 and 23, the state was among eight that saw their populations of unauthorized immigrants grow by 75,000 people, according to the Pew Research Center. At Thursday's press conference, Ileana Santillan, the founder and executive director of Brava NC, a grassroots organization that advocates for the Latino community, said the fear that kept people at home, quote, has an economic cost, a cost we can actually measure. Undocumented immigrants paid nearly $700 million in state and local taxes in 2022. When families are too scared to leave their homes, when workers disappear from jobs, when businesses lose traffic, that tax base erodes. Our schools, roads, and healthcare systems, all of them feel the impact. This administration's mass deportation campaign isn't just chaotic or inhumane, it is economically devastating. During a Monday morning press conference on the NC Capitol grounds, U.S. Congresswoman Deborah Ross and a handful of local elected officials, faith leaders, business owners, and others echoed that economic message. Ross, whose district covers all of Raleigh and most Wake County municipalities, says, Wake County and our state are vibrant, welcoming places. They are made stronger by hardworking immigrants who choose to call our community home. She added the U.S. needs major immigration reforms and noted that she had introduced bipartisan legislation in Congress to that end, Ross. But here's the bottom line. The tactics we have witnessed from CBP over the last week are not the way to do that. Industry advocates like the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association, NCRLA, agree with Ross on the need for reform at the federal level. In a statement to Indy, NCRLA President and CEO Alan Thomas noted the hospitality industry, quote, relies heavily on a stable, reliable workforce, and that it is focused on ensuring the state's restaurant, hotels, and tourism businesses can operate safely and predictably. His statement continued, we support comprehensive, federal immigration reform that provides clarity for employers, protections for workers, and a lawful functioning system that meets the workforce needs of industries like ours. Predictability and consistency are key for employers. Indy reached out to the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce for a statement or interview. We did not receive a response before publication. Mickey Paradis, founder and CEO of PDI Drywall Incorporated, spoke shortly after Ross at Monday's press conference. Her company has been operating in the Triangle for more than 20 years, a record she credits to, quote, commitment and dedication to our country and our economy by the immigrant community. But last week, she noted, business was quiet. Not a hammer swung, not a sheet of drywall hung, nor a wall painted. Millions of dollars that would have come into our state and into our town stopped solely because people in our community, the ones who are willing to do these jobs, were in fear of their lives. Paradis said she is struck by the patriotism of the immigrants of all walks of life with whom she works side by side, day after day, noting that they pay taxes and into programs like Social Security, and they abide by U.S. laws. She told a story about, quote, a man I have worked with for over a decade who came to her recently with tears in his eyes and told her something she will never forget. And she recalled, he said, this country may not claim me, it may not want me here, but it is still my country. I've lived here for over 20 years. My children were born, raised, and educated in this country. We go to the same churches, we pray to the same God as the men who show up in masks and zip-tie our hands and disappear us in the night. I don't know why they hate me, but I hope they know I love them anyway. From Kerry. The first thing they asked Fernando Vasquez was, where are you from? When two unmarked SUVs full of Border Patrol agents arrived Tuesday at the Kerry construction site where Vasquez, 18, is employed, the only thing he could think of was to call his dad and another worker on the site. I just told him run and to hide. The work at the site was virtually complete, with only about 10 workers present on an average day. Because of absences, with fears of Border Patrol and ICE chilling construction sites across the Triangle, Vasquez said there were only about 4 people on the site, part of why he didn't believe they would be targeted. He said, I didn't believe it would happen to me. I was born here. He had left the site to buy a drink at a nearby store. As he walked back, he saw a gray Chevy Tahoe and a black Ford Expedition roll up to the site. He retreated into a fenced-off HVAC area and took out his phone to get a better look at them. But the agents had already spotted him. The ones who approached him wore masks, gloves, and dark glasses. At first, Vasquez reserved his right to remain silent, but when one agent began questioning him in Spanish, he started swearing at them. He said, to make time to stall them. I'm thinking about the workers and my dad. As he tried to step out of the enclosure, he said Border Patrol agents climbed over the fence to corner him. One yanked an AirPod out of Vasquez's ear and set it on the air conditioning unit beside him. When Vasquez tried to retrieve it, put it back in the case, the agent shouted, don't touch me. I'm like, I'm not touching you. And then he said, if you touch me, there's going to be a problem. That was when they handcuffed him and searched him, pulling his wallet out of his pocket. He said they saw my North Carolina real ID. They were looking for an ID or some sort of documentation, so at that moment they could have let me free. But no, they decided to take me. He was placed in the SUV with one of his fellow workers on the construction site, a young man who was crying. As they drove away, the agents continued to question Vasquez, asking him again where he was and where he was born as they went through his wallet. When he told them he was born in Raleigh, the agent questioning him grew angry. Vasquez said they abruptly pulled off the road into the parking lot of a carpet cleaning company where they dumped him, half a mile away from where they picked him up, throwing wallet and cards out of the SUV window as they drove off. He said, I have no idea why they just dropped me off. I kind of felt like I was being kidnapped. His video of Border Patrol uncuffing him and driving away has gone viral on TikTok. accumulating 3 million views and thousands of concerned comments. In the video, an agent with his face covering lowered appears to lunge at the phone with a raised hand, which Vasquez said he believed was an attempt by the agent to conceal his identity. As Vasquez left the SUV, the other detainee asked him, "Tell my brother that they got me." He said, "It devastated me. It broke my heart to realize how two brothers were being separated in front of my eyes." And as he ran back to the site, he called his mom to pick him up. His first reaction was fear that his dad might have been taken in the other SUV. When he told her what happened, she didn't believe him. "Until she heard me running worried and worried, that's when she believed me." When he got back to the site, he told Dad and the detainee's brother, another worker on the site, what happened. "His brother was just outside in shock," he said. The other worker told Vasquez that another vehicle was still patrolling the area, so he called his mom back, warning her not to pick him up. Instead, he got the keys from his dad and drove home himself. Vasquez's encounter with Border Patrol comes as immigration enforcement agencies conduct large-scale raids in Charlotte, Raleigh, and surrounding areas. He was far from the only U.S. citizen to be swept up in them. A spokesman for Customs and Border Protection declined to comment on the incident, but said Thursday that Operation Charlotte's Web in North Carolina has resulted in 370 arrests. Quote, "The operation is not over and it is not ending anytime soon," said Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin in a statement. Earlier, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Jerry McFadden said he had been told by federal agents that Border Patrol operations had ceased in Charlotte, though he noted that ICE will continue to operate in the area, quote, "as they always have." It's unclear whether Border Patrol operations in the Triangle remain ongoing. A spokeswoman for Wake County Sheriff Willie Rowe said their office has had no communication from federal authorities. North Carolina politicians from both parties have urged federal agents to focus their efforts on criminals instead of carrying out indiscriminate arrests. Senator Ted Budd, Republican, North Carolina, wrote in a post on X that operations should target, quote, "those who not only violated our immigration law, but also pose a threat to the communities." He wrote, "Federal law enforcement has been tasked with removing criminal offenders who never should have been in the U.S. They should carry out this mission responsibly to ensure violent individuals are quickly identified, detained, and deported." Governor Josh Stein issued a direct condemnation of ICE and Border Patrol, quote, "for operating in the shadows in the state on Tuesday." He said, "If this were targeted to going after known people who are criminals or known people who are traffickers engaged in violent crime, that would be a good thing. But they're just sweeping sidewalks. They're sweeping parking lots, going into stores and churches. This is causing widespread fear, widespread uncertainty. This is not about public safety, and I wish that it were." Vasquez said he would advise those concerned they could be picked up to carry their documentation with them at all times. If possible, he said, don't leave the house at all. Saying, if you don't have to come outside, don't come outside. If you need any help, ask somebody. Back to Durham, and the public schools face another shortfall as enrollment drops. This is written on the 21st of October, of November. An enrollment drop in DPS will cost that district $4.7 million this year, as well as state funding for 33 teacher positions next year. Local districts receive a blend of local and state dollars based on the number of students enrolled. This year, DPS planned as if it would receive funding for 31,000 students. Because about 1,000 fewer enrolled, the district now has to adjust its budget to match. Durham is not the only district with this problem. Per the superintendent, 112 of North Carolina's 115 public school districts saw an overall drop this year. Here's what these numbers mean for Durham. The district owes charter schools an extra $4.7 million. The county commission dedicated almost a quarter of its $1 billion budget to local schools. DPS receives that money and then, thanks to North Carolina law, must transfer, quote, an amount equal to the per pupil share of public school funding to charter schools, so that when one student leaves DPS for charter, DPS then owes that charter school about $5,700 over the course of the year. Of the total number of Durham students enrolled in DPS and charter schools, DPS projected that about 21% would attend charter this year, which would require the district to pay about $46 million. With charter in actually jumping to around 23%, the district now owes these charters about $51 million total. Charter school transfers only account for about 650 of the total 1,000 drop in enrollment. Other students may have moved to private schools or homeschooling. DPS board chair Bettina Umstead said at a board meeting this week, "It almost feels like deja vu because we were having this conversation last year." Last year's situation was a bit more dramatic. As the budget team found, the district owed charters almost $10 million more than projected. At the meeting, DPS Chief Financial Officer Jeremy Titor ran through a list of options to reduce these expenditures to come up with that $4.5 million. He suggested evaluating service contracts and implementing a hiring freeze, not including bus drivers, positions required by statute or staff who work with special needs students. Teeter said, as an absolute last resort, we have the conversation of reduction in force. That's certainly something we don't want to do, we don't enjoy doing it, and that's why we're evaluating these other options first. Next, the state will fund 33 fewer teacher roles in 26-27. North Carolina pays the bulk of public school teacher salaries. With this enrollment drop, the state will adjust the number of teachers it pays according to meet its ratios. Teeter noted this isn't just an enrollment issue, as Durham has been overstaffing compared to state requirements, overstaffing some schools. Deputy Superintendent Nicholas King could not yet say what that adjustment will look like. He gave the example of grade levels that ordinarily require one teacher per 24 students, but because of the incorrect projections, DPS has some classes with one teacher and only 12 students. He said, and so while we would love to be able to have classes that small, it's just financially unsustainable for us. What can the district do? The best thing for DPS to do is to get students back ASAP. Because it makes payouts to charter schools every month, a student returning to DPS from a charter school has an immediate implication for what we have to share with charters or not share with them. Superintendent Lewis, at the urging of Umstead, said, the administration is studying the enrollment data before creating a multi-year plan to boost enrollment. Board member Natalie Bayer, citing the 1992 city-county school system merger, again railed against charter schools taking local taxpayer dollars, saying, we merged separate but unequal school systems in Durham because we believe in the rich diversity of schools and children coming together to learn, and we believe in equity, and we believe we do better together, said Bayer. Well, finally, something a little bit more positive to read this Thanksgiving weekend. Merrick Moore has been named Durham's first heritage community. Durham native Eileen Watts Welsh was born into a legacy. Watts Welsh has been one of the forces preserving and collecting the history of the Merrick Moore community as one of the great-granddaughters of John Merrick and Dr. Aaron Moore, the neighborhood's namesakes. In 1916, Moore's oldest daughter and Merrick's oldest son married each other. Watts Welsh says, I don't want these stories to be lost. The neighborhood lies in northeast Durham, anchored around Hoover, Cheek, and Junction Roads. Last month, Merrickmore was designated as Durham's inaugural heritage community, a program created by the city's Planning and Development Department to honor communities that have never been formally recognized by the city or county. The goal is to celebrate communities and help them gather research so they can apply for future local or national register designations if they are eligible. Merrick was born into slavery, met Moore while he was laying bricks at Shaw University, where Moore was a medical student. Watts Welsh says, Merrick invited Moore to Durham to provide health care to black residents, many of whom had left tenant farming and were moving to the city in search of jobs, she says. Merrick and Moore co-founded North Carolina Mutual Life Insurance Company, the cornerstone of Durham's Black Wall Street and the country's largest African-American life insurance company. Moore founded Lincoln Hospital in 1901, which his son-in-law, Watts Welsh's father, later developed into the Lincoln Community Health Center in 1970. At the time, it was the only hospital within a 25-mile radius of Durham to treat black patients. Although Merrick and Moore weren't involved in creating the neighborhood, which happened two decades after their deaths, the neighborhood school was named in their honor. Watts Welsh says all blacks who lived in the county, Durham County, went to high school at Merrick Moore, and the county named that Merrick Moore, knowing of all the contributions that both Merrick and Moore had made to education, health care, opportunities for business and family during their lives. Watts Welsh, who is president of the Durham Colored Library, which Moore founded, has worked in her role to preserve the community's history. Merrick Moore Community Development Corporation, MMCDC, has led the efforts to collect and document history as well as preserve the neighborhood's land. Merrick Moore School was one centerpiece of this community. Completed in 1950 as a high school, it was home to 3 basketball championships and 4 runner-up finishes. It also held a football state championship. During integration, the school was converted to an elementary school as it continues to operate today. The other centerpiece of the neighborhood was Mount Zoar, Z-O-A-R, Mount Zoar Baptist Church, which opened in 1865 and was relocated from nearby in the bottom to Merrick Moore in 1953 as more residents moved into the area. Today, the school and the church stand facing each other along Cheek Road and continue to be places of pride for residents. On November 1st, community members gathered for a ceremony unveiling a historical sign outside Mount Zoar that details some of the neighborhood's prominent places and celebrating the designation. In addition to the sign, the Heritage Community Recognition includes an archive at the Durham County Library and a website dedicated to documenting the history of, quote, a community built on kinship, friendship, prayer, and promise. This website begins with the 1940s when black farming families, many of whom were World War II veterans and their relatives, moved to single-family lots, creating a tightly knit community. Then Merrick Moore School opened, marking the first time the name was used. Residents refer to life between 1950 and 70 as the Golden Years, according to the site created by the city, with a school and a neighborhood of families raising children was a village effort. Next came Mount Zoar Baptist Church. Mechanics and Farmers Bank, an offshoot of NC Mutual, issued a loan to cover the land purchase and construction costs of the church. Residents later held a mortgage-burning ceremony in 1960 after it was paid off. Residents took pride in the school's athletic accomplishments, but also the school's newspaper, the Merrick Moore Jet, which regularly won national competitions, and its spelling bee team, which celebrated many wins against Little River High School. Integration was difficult for the neighborhood. According to the city site, students were bused to different formerly all-white school, and Merrick Moore was converted to elementary grades, which meant residents lost the championship-winning high school that had educated many first-generation college graduates. Merrick Mern neighborhood's rural character began to change in 1984 when it was annexed to be part of the city. This, according to the city site, brought higher taxes and greater development potential. It also brought improvements like water, sewer connections, street lamps, paved roads. Merrickmore Community Club, a group of men who repaired homes and did yard work for those who couldn't afford it, led the charge to get the neighborhood incorporated into the city limits. Merrickmore Community Club merged with Merrickmore's Ladies Club in 1997 to create MMCDC, which still works to preserve the neighborhood. Bonita Green, president of the CDC, worked with the city to collect the historic information for the Heritage Project. Green says the desire to have recognition from Durham is to preserve the neighborhood's history and says, "I didn't want this community to be forgotten, or the people who started the community or lived to thrive here to be forgotten people." Green was born in Merrick. Moore and her family was one of the first to settle it. She returned to the neighborhood in 2012, and she helped the CDC reorganize in 2018 and become a nonprofit in 2023. The CDC has done extensive work to preserve its own community history. That's what made Merrick Moore a good first choice for the city's Heritage Communities Program. Carla Rosenberg, senior planner in Durham's Planning and Development Department, along with her staff, spent 6 months collecting history and artifacts from community members this year. She says the process was easier because the CDC had already collected some oral histories and artifacts. She says the Heritage Communities Project was created as a response to accelerated growth and pace of development in Durham County. There is a desire to raise awareness about existing communities that development may affect, she says. The recognition can also be a stepping stone for a designation which carries regulations. And she says this can be sort of a launching pad because of all the research that staff and community conduct together. It creates just a foundation of research that makes a more formal designation that much easier. Now, these National Register designations are voluntary and carry a tax credit process, Rosenberg says, which could make the community more enticing for outside individuals to build in. But it also has requirements for the property's age, significance, and integrity, meaning it has to be at least 50 years old and look similar to how it did, and historically important events or people must be associated with the property, according to the National Park Service. The city of Durham also provides local historic designations which require zoning changes or designation declarations from city or county, and usually a review from the Historic Preservation Commission. Algin Holloway, whom Green refers to as the resident historian, is also a member of one of Merrick Moore's founding families. Holloway says the sign is a great thing. It lets people know the strides that people have made. Mount Zor Baptist Church pastor Bernice Allen says recognition is powerful because it'll help the community have more leverage if it asks the city for assistance, saying, "You can put a sign up anywhere, but when someone else recognizes the work that has been done earlier, that's the power. That means the work didn't go unnoticed. So for work to have not been unnoticed, and for our children and children's children to recognize what had been done and what we expect them to do, that means a lot." Community traditions continue today. Each October, residents gather to celebrate Mount Zor's founding, dressed in traditional clothing like bonnets, and fundraising for the coming year. And the church celebrated its 160th homecoming this year. Green says the city's recognition also helps keep gentrification from wiping the neighborhood out. Her mission has been to establish the legacy of the community and its contributions to Durham. The historical sign is another step toward preserving Merrick Moore. Green says it's a feeling of accomplishment because the initial goal of preserving the legacy of the community is coming to fruition. And Watts Welsh, who has spent about 40 years of her life over time in Durham, says it's wonderful for the community to receive recognition after years of work from community members. Quote, "It's nice that it was named for my great-grandparents, but that community was self-sustaining, and it wasn't because of them that they have thrived. It was because of the members of that community." All right, time for at least one more article. This one is about Catherine Whelan. She's a former singer and the banjo picker of a celebrated group, the Squirrel Nut Zippers. She's flexing verve and versatility on some new records. Within diligent, hardworking bands like Whelan's Jazz Squad and Certain Seas, the musician has been stretching her stylistic wings and flying off toward myriad destinations since the early 90s. Her itinerary stays busy, and her music is always unpredictable. As co-founder of Squirrel Nut Zippers in 1993, Whelan teamed up with then-husband Jimbo Mathos to form a commercial juggernaut of quirky swing, and impish humor. The band's resume includes a platinum album, Hot, a hit single, Hell, appearances on late-night network talk shows, and a performance slot at the 1998 Clinton inauguration. Hot indeed. Following temporary sabbaticals and fluctuating lineups, the group still exists under Mathos' leadership today. Meanwhile, Whelan is charting a course that leads somewhere else. Arriving this month on the Modern Harmonic label, a pair of brand new records featuring Whelan demonstrates her verve and versatility. Waxed before an immersed audience in Hillsborough in March, Down Yonder is Jazz Squad's fourth release and a sunny celebration of Tin Pan Alley-inspired Americana. Meanwhile, Ordinary Hopes by Certain Seas charts that combo's unique blend of edgy folk meets rock tunes, composed by Whelan, guitarist Austin Riopelle, and trombonist Danny Gruen. Somehow, the divergent music of two distinct bands springs from that same trio, Whelan, Riopelle, and Gruen. Whelan explains on the phone from her home in Effland, "Definitely my voice is different in the two bands. In Jazz Squad, I'm trying to serve the song. I'm choosing material I find intriguing and challenging. When I sing in Certain Seas, I'm serving the musicians in the group. I'm telling a story that's based on something we wrote. The songs are not always beautiful and melodic. They can be harsh or just weird." Whelan's term, sparkle folk. If the sparkle folk of Certain Seas is quirky and contemporary, the revivalist set list of Jazz Squad proves that the bread and butter repertoire of American popular song is alive and well. The early compositions of Cole Porter, Hoagy Carmichael, and Duke Ellington grew from seeds planted during the Depression of nearly a century ago. As Whelan understands, old-fashioned artistry still bristles with relevance today when harsh political winds blow hard. She elaborates, "Older music needs to be kept alive and presented in a way that is true to the way the music was performed when it first appeared. Songs are living things. I often think of the original songwriter who was probably tinkling a piano. What did the song sound like back then? What was the intent? I revere older things." She continues, "My grandmother was in theater up in Hendersonville, and she was often involved in performing classical material like Look Homeward, Angel. We didn't have television. We didn't have radio. We had a record player. We had a piano. My grandmother would play things like Chopin's nocturnes. I've always felt connected to older times. Although Waylon wistfully confesses she seldom feels like a modern singer, a recent gig by Certain Seas at Berkeley Cafe in Raleigh animated the room like something fresh out of alt-rock. While dancers spun and drinkers at the bar nodded approval, the Gruen's brass playing, that band's signature bram, moaned sweet and low. On trombone and baritone horn, he blew fat bass lines or whispered in counterpoint to Waylon's and Riopel's intertwined vocals. Whatever the music called for, Gruen provided. Waylon confirms, instantly when I met him, Danny and I just clicked. We started doing our duo thing, Swedish wood control, with tenor guitar and trombone and me singing. He naturally filled up the space that would have been occupied by bass or drums or another voice. What Danny plays just suits me. With the tape machine rolling at the Yonder nightclub, back in March, Jazz Squad regrouped to record a live record. Gruen and Riopel were joined by rollicking pianist Grifonzo, Robert Griffin, while downstage to the right, a percussionist dressed in bright colors struck a cool pose behind a zany set of drums. Of course, you've guessed that Waylon is the drummer, and her little cartoon kit is like unlike any other. She explains, the drums make Jazz Squad a little scarier and spicier for me. I have some bongos, and I have a medium-sized cymbal and a small splash cymbal, and I play with these fantastic sticks. The handle is wooden, like a real drumstick, and the top is not exactly like a wire brush, but the size of big spaghetti and made of plastic. They're just fantastic. They can sound bright or sort of dusky on bongos. Pretty beatnik, huh? She laughs. I started playing drums while I was singing just 2 or 3 years ago, just to make the band sound fuller. I'm not in charge of anything instrumentally. I have no training. I can provide garnishes. I just do what I think sounds good and feels good and grooves. Well, I'm going to have to curtail that article. I'm almost done with Catherine Waylon and two new records being released now with Waylon's Jazz Squad and the group Certain Seas. You've been listening to a report about these two releases and about Miss Waylon in general. So John Fetterson must go away and cook some things because it is Thursday. You'll hear this first broadcast on Friday, and after that, Indie Week will be in the podcast division of the North Carolina Reading Service, which now bids you farewell and happy holiday weekend, everybody.